Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Kate Loving and the Collective Wisdom. My name is Kate Loving Shank, and I am the host of this show. Please join me in welcoming Donald Altman, author of the new book, 1 Minute Mindfulness. Mindfulness is a spiritual practice that has virtually gone mainstream here in this country. More and more Americans realize that they need to heed the call to calm down. The call-in number is 347-205-9200. Please join me now in welcoming Donald Altman. Hello, Donald.
Oh, hello, Kate. It's great to be with you today.
Thank you for being on the show.
I'm very happy to have you. Oh, well, thanks. And you're talking about my favorite passion, which is mindfulness.
How long have you been passionately involved with mindfulness?
Well, I should say that I was passionately involved with mindlessness a lot longer. And that was my journey that led me into mindfulness. I was a very mindless eater for many years, and it bothered me that I couldn't moderate my eating, and I was an emotional eater. But it was a wonderful pathway into mindfulness and discovering the joys of mindfulness in all areas of my life, not just food.
So you started out with the eating thing, the eating mindfully.
Yeah.
A discipline, I would call it, because I think that I have found eating mindfully to be probably the last frontier for me. I just can't do it. I want to so much, though.
Well, join the club because mindful eating is really it's a challenge, and it takes a lot of work. I'd say in terms of different levels of mindfulness, it's right up there, like, you know, scoring a 10 on the balance beam or one of these gymnastics events. It really requires a tremendous amount of focus and presence in the moment to really just eat when you're eating.
Eat when you're eating.
To be distracted. Think about how distractible we are nowadays. You know, a lot of times I'll ask when I do workshops, and I'll ask people, how many people here eat while you're doing something else? And almost every hand goes up, and people eat while they're working at the computer or watching television and really aren't as present with just eating, to eat when you eat. And that's a very powerful process if you can allow yourself to do that.
Yes, I have to admit that I am in the camp where I will prepare a little meal and then do 10. I don't even sit at the computer and eat. I'll take a few bites. This is a terrible confession, but just running around, come back and take a few bites, do this and do that, and come back and it almost reminds me of some sort of addiction.
If you could be present with those few bites, that would be wonderful. Even if you move around, right?
Right. Well, let me just tell the people in the chat room here that Donald Altman is with me, and we are now on the topic of eating mindfully. That is eating just because you're eating and not doing all kinds of other things in the process.
Right. And maybe I could mention that I am I'm the vice president of the Center for Mindful Eating, which is tcme.org. And so people might want to check that out. I mean, we do have handouts for people. It's really more organized toward professionals who are in the field, you know, dietitians and people, you know, therapists and others working with eating issues. But I think anybody could probably benefit from going there.
Oh, well, so that is quite interesting to me that you just reminded me that you could use this discipline for the various eating disorders that are so prevalent in our society.
Yeah, that's true. In fact, this is a really interesting story. If I'd like to tell you a quick story about when I actually worked in an eating disorder clinic for about 3.5 years. My journey with mindless eating led me into the monastery, and I wrote a book called Art of the Inner Meal, which was about the spiritual side of eating and mindful eating. And when I started to do different workshops around that, people would come to me with serious eating disorders, and that led me to go back to school, get a graduate degree in counseling, and specialize in the eating disorder area. So I worked at this eating disorder clinic, and one day I was leading a group, and a lot of the I could tell the group was kind of struggling, and I said, "What's wrong?" And they said, "Well, we're stuck in our eating disorder thoughts. You know, we have these eating disorder stories going," and often that's very true of that group of people. So I said, "Okay." But the truth is really that for just anybody, generally, the mind, when you're in default mode, the brain goes, starts creating stories. And we can go off into storytelling. And the interesting thing is that mindfulness pulls the plug on that default storytelling network of the brain and gets you into the flow of the moment. So what I did with those, it was all females, I said, "Okay, let's all stand up. I'm going to have us explore our group room like maybe we've never looked at it before." And they looked at me like I was kind of crazy, and because many of them had been there for 2 or 3 months. And they said, "Come on, Donald, we know this room." And I said, "Well, just humor me and let's try this." So here they were with all these, you know, old stories of eating disorder, preoccupation, thoughts going on in their head. And I directed them to explore the room with moment-by-moment awareness and curiosity, to even look at the walls and see where the sunlight came in from the blinds and maybe, you know, faded out the paint a little bit, to look at the little wrinkles in the paint, to notice little cracks in the concrete in the floor or the group table where they worked at, to see the grains of wood and how they were different. And we did this for quite a while, 15 minutes. And then I said, "Okay, everybody." I even had them each hand take something out of their pocket and with their eyes closed hand it to somebody and let that person experience and think what it was, what that object was, right? So after 15 minutes of this, they sat back down. I said, "Okay." And they were shocked when I said 15 minutes had passed. And then I said, "So tell me, where were your eating disordered thoughts? Where were the stories you had running in your heads?" And their jaws dropped.
Mm-hmm.
Because the story stopped, they were in the present moment.
Yeah.
And one of them raised her hand. She said, "You know, I feel like I left the fantasy world and entered reality."
Oh,
and then another girl raised her hand and said, "And she said, yeah, and I don't think I like that reality. She said, "I don't think I like my dream world being interrupted."
Oh.
Wow. So
yes.
This just goes to show you the power of being in the present moment. It was a real victory for them to see that they didn't have to live in that fantasy world, which for them, I mean, that's a very dangerous disorder, whether it's bulimia or anorexia, in terms of the health issues and so on, and one of the highest mortality rates among mental illnesses. For them to be able to see that there was something else was a very triumphant moment, I think, for all of them. And that's the beauty of, no matter, even though our minds normally wander, and these studies have been done, our minds wander about 48% of the time on average.
Oh, my heavens.
Half the time. And what researchers have found is that our happiness depends on whether or not we're present with the activity we're doing. The activity itself isn't as important as if we're present with it, because when our minds are wandering, they show that we're less happy.
Yes. So this now, is a tremendous anecdote, then. Mindfulness is a tremendous antidote to depression and unhappiness and anxiety.
I think if we are stuck in stories, if our minds are, if we're ruminating or stuck in stories around anxiety or worries about the future or things in the past that happened to us, and those stories are predominant, then we really can't see that beautiful little hidden treasure that is right there before us right now.
Yes.
I'm not saying don't ever have your stories or don't ever have your fantasies. I think that, fantasies could be important for creativity. And it's important for us to know the stories and our family and our history to know where we want to go. But the point is that we want to blend. We want to understand our past, but we want to also be able to be here now and
stories you're referring to, though, may be very much victim-oriented. And those are the stories that are not helping anybody, certainly the person who are having them, but not even anybody in their environment.
Right.
The victim Go ahead.
Yeah. No, I agree with what you're saying. You could create a different story, an empowering story for yourself, a story of gratitude to look at what you have in your life, which could be very beautiful.
Well, what you mentioned, you told that beautiful story in your book about the woman who had not been helped by any discipline at all until she got an alphabet bracelet.
Oh, yeah.
That story.
That's a great story. I was doing a workshop, and this lady, and I had mentioned gratitude and was talking about gratitude. And this lady came up, and she had this bracelet on, and she proceeded to tell me about how she had been so depressed and so miserable, just in general, in her life. And I think she worked in the medical field that people would avoid her. I mean, she was really not pleasant to be around, and grumpy and always complaining and miserable. And she'd taken every antidepressant under the sun. But then she decided to try gratitude. And what she did with this bracelet was she created her own little bracelet, and it had the letters A through Z on there, and every day she would take the next letter, so let's say the letter B, and she would think of everything with the letter B that she had gratitude for, like breakfast, right, or I don't know what other letter B she might have, but so she would think about all those things every day, write down all of those things with that letter every day. And it changed her view. She, instead of looking at things through the lens of what was missing in her life, she looked through what was present in her life. And she literally inoculated herself against depression and pessimism and taking things for granted. And so people would come up to her as she started to discover this gratitude. And they would ask her they'd notice, say, well, you really like a different person now. Are you on a new antidepressant? And she would say, yeah, I'm on gratitude.
Love that. Love it. Oh, my gosh. You know, that says so much about gratitude and mindfulness, how the two are interwoven. And because when you are counting your blessings and really concentrating on everything that is involved with the things that you have and don't need or want, you're not concentrating or in needs and wants, but on what you have and what you love about your life, then your whole life changes. And that's something that has certainly gone through the manifesting movement that you read so much about.
Mm-hmm.
I
have more than one chapter actually on gratitude because I think it's so important. I have a chapter of gratitude at work, and then I have another chapter called Pray for What You Already Have.
Yeah.
That way you'll never be disappointed. if you pray for what you already have in your life. I really think that what you're saying is very important, that mindfulness can help us tap into the gratitude.
There's
and
something,
that affects our mood, too.
There's something very mesmerizing about the way that you write the book. You're not saying that everybody has to do this forever. You're just saying they have to do it for just the next minute. And you write about that several times, you know, many, many times throughout the book, do this and this in the next minute. And it has a way of making it possible for your readers.
I think that's why this book is really is connecting with people, because I think when 1 minute mindfulness says you can do this, and you can, mm-hmm. all you need to do is just slow down and be here for this next minute. And in the next minute, you could make some new choices. No matter what choices you've made in the past, instead of blaming yourself for those, you could look at this next minute and say, what do I want to do right now that would be beneficial, that would be good for me, that would maybe be good for others? I only have to make one little decision in this moment.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful.
I mean, and that's what,
because you're really not putting it off. You're not putting anything off because you're doing it right now.
Yeah, it's kind of really a. It's nice because it's and it has. It can only be. It can be a small little thing. It doesn't have to be some giant momentous event or kind of action that you take. It could be that one small ordinary action. But if you keep doing those small intentional ordinary actions, you end up with an extraordinary life.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, I like to think of Mother Teresa, who, even when she had doubts, she would just keep doing the things she needed to do, right? She made that next decision in the next minute, and she was present for people, trying to be there for people each 60 seconds that she could.
Yeah.
And she did something very extraordinary, but what she did is nothing different from what any of us really could do in the next 60 seconds.
Yes.
And that's very empowering, I think.
Yeah, because I even had this, when I started to get this idea of the next 60 seconds from your book, I would look at my watch and see where the 60-second mark began. And
oh,
then I
would love that.
Do it, and then I'd notice that the 60-second may have, you know, gone on, but then you just bend your mind around that and go into the next 60 seconds, which really reminds me of what mindfulness really is. And what I have noticed in the past with my experience with it is that all of a sudden you realize there isn't any time at all. Or mm-hmm. if time does really exist, it is eternity. It feels like there's no boundaries. And it's almost like a mind-altering perception. And so for just mm-hmm. quickly, you know, for people like me who've been in the medical profession for years, where you rush in there and you clock into a time clock. Every action that you do within the organ with your patients has to be timed. When did this happen? When did that happen? But there's just something that is eternal about mindfulness that I think does speak to the Buddhist traditions.
Yeah, it for example. You can't take a breath for yesterday or for tomorrow. You have to breathe right now. And I like to say that your breath is your intimate kiss with this moment and your intimate way of getting into the body. Everybody who is listening to this, let's take one conscious breath right now, breathing in, noticing how the lungs are filling up, maybe the abdomen is moving. Be present with the whole in-breath. And even the pause between the breath and as you exhale, be present with the complete exhale. Even maybe hearing the sound of your breath as it's leaving through the nostrils or the mouth. And that is a beautiful way to be here in this moment with the breath, which means that you're being sensitive to your body and you're calming your body at the same time. It's a very important thing that we need to remember.
And to breathe diaphragmatically.
Yeah, and to breathe diaphragmatically. If you notice that your chest is moving when you're taking a breath, you really want to try to get that breath further down in the lungs, because if you're breathing high up in the lungs, you're really more vulnerable to the stress response. And one easy way to do that is to either put your hands behind your back, clasp your hands behind your back, or put your hands behind your head for a moment and raise your arms up. Don't do this while you're driving.
Well, it sounds like it might be better than tech. It might be better to text than to do this. just kidding.
And what you're doing is you're opening up the rib cage, you're stretching the intercostals, which are muscles that run through the ribs and hinge the ribs open and let you get a deeper breath. And you may just notice, if you take 3 or 4 breaths like this, that you feel calmer. I've had people say they feel a little tingly. Some people get giddy, kind of laugh. This feels good.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you conduct workshops on this discipline?
I do. I do workshops on mindful eating and mindful living. I do workshops for professionals, and I do workshops just for regular groups of people who want to learn how to get more present in their lives.
Yes. Oh, my gosh, you must really have a great time.
Oh, we have fun. We have fun. We do a lot of breathing. And, you know, we do mindful walking, and which is also a lot of fun. Because.
Oh, I bet.
Yeah, because that kind of, if you're really paying attention to each step as if you've never taken that step before, wow, really a very different experience for people. And again, the mind, that overactive mind, tends to stop or slow down, and you're really dropping into the body. And when you drop into the body, you really are experiencing this moment in a very powerful way.
That's right.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, then people really can take this into their lives live that way as best they can and just keep growing with it.
What I've tried to do with the 1 Minute Mindfulness book is to get people to think about little things that are moments that they've never thought about before. So for example, my first chapter in the book is called Morning Awakens, and it's about all those little movements and things in the morning that maybe you take for granted. Like, what does it feel like when your finger is lifting the light switch in the morning? Or when you're first opening your eyes and, you know, do you stretch your body out, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what is it like when when you feel the water from the shower dancing over your head and your body? Do you really allow yourself just to really experience it? What is the first taste or the last taste you take in a day? Do you remember that first taste of today? Was it memorable? You know, the funny thing is, in terms of brain science, a negative memory can occur very quickly and stay with us a long, long time. But positive memories, in order for them to have the same kind of enduring effect on the brain, I should say enduring and endearing effect on the brain, is that we need to practice them. We actually need to remember them. We need to really savor the moment for maybe up to, you know, 5 times as long as a negative memory to have that positive memory take hold.
Why is the negative so?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. I think if you think of it in terms of maybe evolutionary survival needs, the brain figured, you know, you better not pass over anything that could cause you harm. A pleasant thing might occur any time, but that won't take your life, right?
Yeah.
Our brains are kind of wired for, you know, like Velcro for negativity. But that doesn't mean that has to be the default setting, and I'm not suggesting that we just ignore that or throw that out. That part of the brain serves an important purpose, and at the same time, we need to balance that out and not have that, be predominant.
Well,
and that's what mindfulness can do.
I was going to say, I guess one way to look at it is that you can't get post-traumatic stress disorder from pleasant thoughts. And
it's highly unlikely.
So, you know, that's why the traumatic experiences stick with people, because they, oh my heavens, you know, the trauma is hard to shake. And that would bring us back to how mindfulness can heal trauma. How about physical pain, extreme physical pain?
I've worked with a lot of people with different physical chronic conditions, a lot of some rheumatoid arthritis or multiple sclerosis or different other kinds of chronic pain. And what I've seen is that, and actually there's been a lot of research around mindfulness with pain. And what I've seen is that it helps change people's relationship to the pain. Mm-hmm. It's not that it makes the pain go away, but it changes their story around the pain. It changes how they perceive the pain. And, you know, you may have a story around pain. If you have chronic pain, the story could be, this is just ruining my life. I hate this. I can't, mm-hmm. I can't go running like I used to. Let's imagine that, for example, that I fell and injured my hip. And so, my whole summer is ruined, and I wanted to play tennis this summer. I can't do that. This really is, mm-hmm. I don't have anything good about this, and I hate it. So there's that story, right? But then the pain in the hip might actually be, it's a moment-to-moment sensation. And you could experience it in a very different way, than just the story around it.
Yeah, yeah.
The pain, and actually, this... I use the hip as an example because I once fell trying to help my cat get away from this dog. It was an act of loving kindness gone awry. And I spent 6 months on, a month in a wheelchair and 6 months on crutches.
Oh, you're so sorry.
And so I remember laying in bed shortly after this happened, and I was on antibiotics. My cat also bit me. and I had these thoughts come up around what had happened, mm-hmm. and the thoughts were not flattering or pleasant. It was like, oh, how stupid of that was me. Why did I do that? I should have done this or that. And I stopped myself. I said, no, I'm already in pain. Do I need suffering? Do I need to add suffering to this? And I decided the suffering was optional. And I would have done it differently next time. But the story wasn't helping me. And I could handle the pain, and I did. And so I think, in answer to your question, that this can help us change our relationship to our anxiety, to our to depressed mood, to loss or grief in our life, and to physical pain, even chronic, difficult pain.
Yes, it reminds me of, speaking of hips, I'd gone to visit my brother just about a year ago today, or a week or whatever. He had fallen and broken his hip, and he was, hung up, and our mother had broken out her hip, and became chronically depressed. So I could tell that he needed a little help with, just nursing sort of help, but also mental help. So mm-hmm. I went down and took the reins for a while, not a whole long time, but when I got there, he was very depressed. And he was telling himself stories about our mother who fell and broke her hip, and that was around the same age, and then she... died to several years. He was telling himself these stories. So as the week progressed, we would take these, he had a walker, and we took very small steps up the street. And then he'd pause at a tree and tell me a story about something that happened there. And as the week progressed, he goes, this is really a very valuable experience because every step I take, I have to be in that step. I have to be in the present moment. And he really slowed down. He got off the internet. He got off all technology and just
meditated.
Wow,
that's wonderful.
Yeah, and it was really by the time I left, we actually watched a Rolling Stones movie, and he was dancing in his chair. So it was great.
He didn't get too attached to that story about your mother. He was able to let it go.
No, we have to let that one go. That's very important.
Yeah.
We have a question in the chat room as to whether you actually do the practice of yoga. She said, it sounds like you do yoga off the mat, but wondering if you actually do the practice of yoga.
I have done some yoga, but I am not a yoga practitioner.
Yes.
But I think yoga is a wonderful practice, and it is a very meditative practice. For me, the movement is mindful walking that I do mostly. I do other kinds of stretching, but I don't. I know people who do yoga every day, and I think it's a wonderful practice.
And
maybe I'll get inspired.
Yes,
it does.
Well,
absolutely.
Our friend in the chat room has had a lot of chronic pain problems. She had polio as a child. And she wouldn't mind me telling you this because she tells people. She had polio as a child and then suffered from post-polio syndrome. She ran the Boston Marathon. And she's a really remarkable woman.
That's
and now
awesome.
She does yoga, and she's just a beautiful, beautiful person.
That's awesome. So yoga really seems to be helping her stay physically conditioned and also mindful.
Mindful, very mindful.
Yeah, that's great.
You know, when you look at some of the problems in our society, and I would say the American society, maybe more than others, I think about insomnia, and I think about addiction. But let's start with insomnia. I'm sure you have seen great strides with people who practice mindfulness and who have had sleep disorders.
The average American has about a 200 to 500 hour per year sleep deficit.
Mm-hmm.
That's huge. And a lot of daytime problems that people are experiencing are because they're not getting enough sleep at night. And I think that mindfulness can help that, because it means being aware of creating a sleep ritual. I even talk about how paying attention to how you go to sleep at night.
Mm-hmm.
You know, are you watching, are you looking at the computer or the TV or, you know, electroluminescent devices? That light goes through the retina and actually delays melatonin production.
Right.
So I think we need to be very mindfully aware of our sleep needs and putting in place boundaries that can help us get enough sleep. Because, you know, if you're not getting enough sleep, it's going to be harder to be mindful, I think.
Yes. Yes, because the other night, I work night shifts, so that doesn't help from the very beginning, actually. But we love night shift because there's great teamwork and hilarity and laughter, because the more sleep-deprived you become, the more ridiculous everything seems. But anyway, I had to go after my third 12-hour night shift, and I had to extend that night into day, like for 16 hours, and somebody said something that I would have normally been very patient with, and I just completely, and it was a very extreme thing that you said. But nevertheless, if I had had more sleep, I would have been more patient with what you said. And I just completely had a knee-jerk reaction. So there's a good example. I would have done things differently had I had more sleep. That's basically the only thing I can say. I did make amends. I made amends. I apologize, although I certainly don't think her idea would have been a good one. I won't even go into detail about what that idea was. But that's not the point. The point is if we have enough sleep, and it does make mindfulness easier, it makes respect easier, it just makes you more balanced and centered.
I agree with that completely, and I think our brain needs the sleep too to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been a lot of research around that. If we want to remember those nice, pleasant memories, we need enough sleep to keep them. To keep them in mind.
Yes. And what about addiction?
Well, again, I think mindfulness is real important in changing toxic habits and even addictions. And it's really about paying attention, mm-hmm. paying attention to your thoughts, paying attention to cravings, and then setting a new direction in that next 60 seconds. Mm-hmm. It's also about, I think what also helps with addictions is not just noticing craving, and you can ride the craving almost like you would surf a wave, right? You can notice the craving as it increases, and then as it decreases. And so you're not pushing it away, you're experiencing it completely. Well, I think the other aspect with addictions is to reach out to people and find resources. And what a lot of people don't understand, mindfulness is sometimes interpreted as, oh, it's the experience I'm having in this moment. But mindfulness is very much also a shared experience. And I think we're going to see more and more of that viewpoint and way of experiencing mindfulness, and the idea that, even as we're here together in this interview, we're listening to one another, we're responding, we're allowing space, right, and we're being present with one another, and things happen that you could not have scripted, you couldn't have known would happen. Mm-hmm. That's that shared mindful moment that occurs, and it's really about allowing space for each person, and not judging that other person and being present, giving that other person the gift of being who they are and listening to them without judgment or it's setting aside your opinions for a moment and being with anybody, even somebody who might be a very so-called difficult person in your life, and how can you even be with that person and be open and present? Maybe take a curious stance. That's the other thing I think is real nice about a mindfulness in a relationship-centered approach, is to just be curious.
Mm-hmm.
To set aside your assumptions, be curious, and really try to understand, how did this person get to have these ideas or have this particular viewpoint? And in the process of just understanding, right, you open your heart up a little bit to them.
Yes, compassion.
Compassion, yeah.
I'm just about to go to New York City on October the 14th to be with Thich Nhat Hanh for a day. I thought you would find
wonderful.
That to be pretty cool. I think he's...
That is cool.
Yeah, something about the global ethics and treading the earth lightly kind of thing.
Mm.
And we will be there for a whole day in the middle of the craziness of Manhattan, in the middle of crazy demonstrations and, the uprising of the revolution. We will be in a mindful state.
Well, how about a mindfulness revolution or mindfulness revolution?
The mindfulness evolution. I love it. Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, it begins within, right?
Yes.
And it is about, and I think it very much is about treading very lightly and with a conscious awareness, moving purposefully through your life, intentionally, so that you're not treading too hard, that you're trying to be sustainable in how you live your life, creating sustainable relationships in your life.
Yes.
And it means being more aware. We can't change what we're not aware of. And I think that
isn't that a beautiful statement? Yes.
And mindfulness can help us start to notice, start to become more aware, and then we can start to make the changes we want.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very cool that you're going to that. Have you planned that for a long time?
It was actually a spontaneous decision a few months ago. And I'm meeting my old friend who disappeared for 15 years, and we thought he had died. And we all thought that we tried to find him and so forth. And he suddenly reemerged. He had been institutionalized for major depression for 15 years. So... He's in this wonderful creative space of writing plays, and he's really on his right path. And although he hasn't really written about the institutional, the experience in the institution, which I know he will, because I think that would be very therapeutic for him. Mm-hmm. But anyway, he and I are going to this wonderful Thai Nhat Hanh workshop, and I just know it will transform both of us in ways that we don't even have any idea about.
Right.
Just to be in the presence of the master kind of idea.
Yeah.
And I think it'll be...
Well, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
You're devoting your time to doing something beneficial like that.
Thank you.
And reconnecting with an old friend.
Oh, he's really my oldest friend, and I just every day I have a tremendous amount of gratitude for the fact that he is with us on this planet. I don't have to see him all the time. Just the idea that he's still with us is a truly mind-blowing experience.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, there's a person who truly lives in a mindful state, doesn't he? And, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh said something very interesting about Thomas Merton. Now, you may have heard, but I just want to tell you anyway. He said that Thomas Merton knows how to shut a door.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, so the act of opening and shutting a door can really, you know how people when they get angry and they're just all befuddled, they'll just slam doors and throw papers and what have you. But the mindfulness action of opening and shutting a door quietly, of lifting a paper or putting a paper down or just pulling out a chair or pulling in, everything that you do is just gentle. And,
There's also the idea that you're not rejecting this moment, that you're embracing the moment. So if I reject the moment, maybe I'm doing something just to get it out of the way, to get it over with. And so I'm almost fighting against it. So even that door becomes something, it's an obstacle for me.
Yes.
And I might slam it out of my frustration or my anger or whatever. Or I could be present, just opening the door to open the door. Not to even to walk through it, just to open the door. What would that be like? Walking through the door just to walk through the door.
Yes.
Closing the door just to close the door. Devoting yourself...
Go ahead.
Yeah, devoting yourself 100% to the experience you're having at any time.
And then the transition of moving from one room to the next and going to value or to really notice, as you say, the transitions in our lives all day long.
I have an
opportunity.
That I think it's really important to notice the transitions or the thresholds in our lives. In fact, I even have a chapter in the book, and they're all short chapters, by the way, a couple of two and a half pages. But I have one called "Stepping Over the Threshold," and I talk about thresholds awaiting us at every turn, and that every threshold, whether it's walking through a door, there are emotional thresholds, right? I'm changing my mood. There are physical energy thresholds, tiredness, high energy, or whatever. There are so there are these different thresholds, and each one we pass through is important because we can set an intention. We can be aware that we're moving through a threshold, and we can bring intentionality and awareness to that.
Yes.
And then we don't have to live with regret that we did something mindlessly, or we hurt somebody, or we suffered needlessly. So I even have, and I must share this, I have a little intention that anyone can use here when you're moving from one place to another. And so I have these little reflection moments, too, that people can actually practice, and they take less than a minute. So this one is, in the next minute, may I be open to each moment. May my actions be kind. May they be beneficial. May they be of service. So imagine when you come home, before you enter the house, and you just center yourself, and you say this little, five-line number of intentions here.
Mm-hmm.
you know, it can remind you that your purpose here is to be kind. Your purpose here is to reconnect with the family or whatever, whoever. And but again, it's about not just falling into old habits and old routines, but seeing things fresh.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that part about
staying connected with your purpose.
Purpose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then to make that that sounds like an affirmation, really, an affirmation for your next moment. Of course, now
right, it's an affirmation or an intention.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Of course, what you just said may have taken a moment to say. Well, you know, say your intention in one moment and then live it the next moment, maybe.
Yeah, well,
but
the next moment you're living it. So you set the intention and then you're following it through. Yeah.
And then I love the part about listening and mindfulness, because that takes a lot of focus to listen.
Listening is, it's kind of a gift that a lot of us don't really give to others. Everybody is kind of trying to get their story out, and which is fine, but we also need to listen. And listening without judgment really helps create connection with other people. It really allows them to know. And the other part is not just the listening, but then sharing back what you heard,
mm-hmm.
even without adding an opinion or anything, just really letting, say, oh, you know, so you said this and that, huh? So this happened to you. Wow. And all, you know, somebody feels very validated by hearing that, right? Without adding your two cents in, but just letting somebody know you heard it. Or maybe it helps them make better sense out of their story. And you could ask questions. So what was that like when this happened or that happened? And then they start to make better sense. They start to understand their story. And this is, again, shared mindfulness.
Yes.
Through storytelling. It's beautiful to be able to help somebody deepen their story and their understanding of their own story.
Right. And then there's the beautiful sacredness of sitting with somebody in silence.
Mm-hmm. I think it was George Washington Carver, who used to sit, and he was the guy that found all the uses for the peanut plant and some other plants. I don't know if you remember.
Yes. Yes.
And he would go out at 4 in the morning, and think about this, 4 in the morning, and just sit in silence with the peanut plants. And he said, you know, I didn't discover anything. He said, what I learned is if you sit in silence anything with any person or anything, it will share all its secrets with you. If you sit in silence and show it love, it will share all its secrets.
And you will be able to feel it grow, right? You'll be able to feel those plants grow, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's, getting back to, that reminds me of mindfulness and your animals and mindfulness in nature. Nothing quite brings you back to the sacredness of this present moment than sitting, well, with my dog, for instance. He is the most, he isn't a real loud creature. You know, he's very silent. He follows me silently, but if I watch him, he's always aware. He's always looking at me. He's always, you know, imparting a message. But just being with him has taught me more than anything in the world about what we're talking about.
Well, you know, dogs are very mindful of the moment, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. They are very attentive and very paying a lot of attention. You know, people have asked me what kind of practices I use, there's 5 different sections in this book, and there's 1 minute mindfulness for home and play, work and creativity. There's a section on relationships and love, health and well-being. But the section that I have been lately using a lot personally is 1 minute mindfulness for nature, spirituality, and contemplation, which is kind of what you're talking about, and how to connect with the beauty of nature, the silence of nature, that nature will share its own lessons with us, and to sit out in nature, even when we're in the midst of difficulties in our life, we can give it up to nature, to something bigger, something wiser than ourselves, and just open to the possibility of what may occur when we do that.
Yes, and then, it would be maybe especially when you're feeling disquietude to go directly into nature for that remedy.
I think it's important because our lives are becoming less and less quiet, and our minds then become less and less quiet, and we need to find a way to find some solitude, some silence, some space. Spaciousness, even in our own mind, and that can give us new clarity and a sense of wisdom and help us find our direction. And so that's the role that nature can play for anybody, I think, is to, we need to find that time just to gaze at a tree or gaze up at the sky or the moon. And just
the moon. The moon and the stars. Yes, absolutely. But, you know, and sometimes nature isn't as quiet. You know, recently we had some very wild storms.
I live
along a river here, and it's the Conestoga River, and usually it's very calm.
Mm-hmm.
But these storms, now it was the Hurricane Irene, which was very windy. And then a few days later, Hurricane Lee came raining through.
Mm-hmm.
And our river flooded and came within 20 feet of our home, even though our home was
not at
all flooded. Well, it was a raging river. It was raging past with 60 miles, maybe 20, 30 miles per hour. It looked like much more, but big logs and things, you know, just raging through. And I thought, wow, what a difference. You know, it's quite amazing how, the wind with cracking trees and those clouds can be so dramatic. And so, but even to be in that presence, no matter what nature is doing, is such a gift.
I agree. I think that, and I think it's a great point you made that nature is not always quiet. It can be very loud. It can be dangerous. It can be scary. And nature has as many moods as human beings can have.
Yes.
Right? But we also know that
Yes. I was going to say climate changes could be responsible for some of this. And I was very disturbed by when the river did come up to our home. It had a smell that I can't say was completely obnoxious, but it was reminding me that the river is polluted, and that was very troubling and sad to me.
Mm.
But Donald, I know that you needed to leave us a little bit early so you can get on with your evening. You have a client and so forth, so I don't want to hold you up with that.
Okay, well, Kate, I really, really, really enjoyed talking with you. It was really a lot of fun.
It really was, yes.
And I appreciate the work that you're doing and spreading wisdom and allowing me to talk about 1 minute mindfulness. And could I just mention where people could find the book?
Please.
Yeah, I have a website, 1minutemindfulnessbook.com, and it's spelled O-N-E, 1minutemindfulnessbook.com. And I also have a 1 minute mindfulness Facebook page. It tells new little interesting things that are happening with the book and with mindfulness. So I invite everybody to like that. And thanks again for having me on. Well, blessings to you and your audience.
Thank you very much, Donald. I really appreciate it. This was blessings to you and your evening. So thank you.
Okay. Take care. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. I'm going to be playing music for Mother and Child, and here we go.